At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome, one and all, to Knife Talk, the, well, certainly the best podcast for knife makers out there. This is episode 226. Can you believe that already? So, hosted by myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, the great Mareko Momasi of Momasi Fire Arts, and normally we have Jeff Fader, Fader Knives, with us, but he's not with us today. But don't be sad. Two out of three in part, as they say. So he's at the CMAs, which, as we all know, is the Country Music Awards. So he's up for an award for the best upcoming artist for his single I'm With You, which is that famous duet with Kenny Rogers. So we wish him all the best for that at the CMA.
Absolutely.
So yeah, you go for it, Jeff. We're with you. I'm with you, Jeff, as they say.
Yeah, I'm with you.
In his sequined suit, I can imagine it.
I can see it. Yeah, for sure.
How are things, Mareko? You good?
Doing good, yeah. Nice stuff. It's pretty straightforward. Yeah, these past few months, we've been kind of diversifying how I make an income from the knife making stuff, which is where like the Patreon comes in. We had the and still have the apron going, the calendars and all that stuff. So Fridays are meeting day, and that's also when we're recording the podcast. So meeting day with my wife and I, and we just kind of discuss and go over all these things and some of the other things we have coming up. In addition to the Sacramento show coming up with the Forged to Table show at the end of April, I'm also going to be trying to coordinate some teaching stuff. I have some other shows in September and that I'm going to be at in Nashville. And so I'm talking to Jason Knight about doing a class at his shop out there. And then I'm going to be up at Makers Camp in October, and basically like 2 weeks later. And I'm trying to coordinate, you know, basically trying to make all these trips work double duty. So I'm not just going out for one thing. I might as well make the most of it. So going out and probably trying to arrange a class either, you know, I have a friend named Zach Jonas who does classes or holds classes at his shop in New Hampshire. But there's also Dragon's Breath Forge, my old shop, that I might try to go and coordinate something with them as well. Cool. So just a lot of juggling. There's a lot of juggling going on right now.
Yeah, and events, which is cool, because, I mean, we've had, what, 2-3 years of not being able to do much, so you're cramming it all in. Sounds good.
For sure. Oh, and one, this last week I signed a contract to be part of a local kind of crafters market that happens here, and I'm not really going to be peddling my knives, but I've been wanting to offer a knife sharpening service locally here in my community for a while, because to me, it's a low impact on me mentally and time wise. Like it's a very easy thing for me to do, right? Like between a machine and maybe a stone, it takes about 5 minutes to sharpen a knife. Yeah. And you know, I'm doing my knife sharpening from an understanding of metallurgy and blade geometry and all that kind of stuff. We have one guy in the local area that offers a knife sharpening, but it's kind of an old school dude with, like, I think he rolls around with a bench grinder.
And oh, wow.
God knows what kind of glorious damage he's doing to people's knives, overheating blades and stuff like that. So I think, I guess I just feel like there's an opportunity to offer a service with a lot more depth of knowledge and understanding about the tools that are being cleaned up and whatnot. And like I said, it's an easy thing for me to do to help kind of to offer a service in my community.
Yeah. And it's like visibility too, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's being out there, it's meeting people. And
yeah. Cool. Well, and I used, you know, I grew up in this town, and so it's kind of stepping back into not a role as a community leader, but just being more kind of involved with the community. You hear Jeff talk about all the different things he does in Peekskill and in Westchester, and you know, you're playing music at these various venues and stuff, or have been. And I've been wanting to, honestly, I've been talking to my wife about doing a sharpening and offering a sharpening service for a couple of years. But again, just like one of my biggest problems is I have too many ideas and too many things I want to try to do. Yeah. And that was just gonna, this one actually requires my time. And so it has been put on the back burner. Because I actually have to physically be there, and that creates a lot of challenge between balancing life, knife making and family and all that.
And but like traveling. You said, low impact stuff. It's, you know, it doesn't require much thought beforehand. It's just rocky. What, you're doing it like from a van or like from a stall? What kind of
setup? Yeah, so it'd probably be like a stall with like a pop-up tent or something like that.
Cool.
And I you know, with the Broadbeck, I can just run it off of a 110, and for the sharpening, like a 110 volt extension cord, and because I'm doing the sharpening at such a low power usage that it's not gonna burn anything up. And so I'm usually down at like 20 or whatever. On the dial, it says around 20. That's usually where I'm at when I'm sharpening, because, again, I'm trying to preserve the heat treat of the knife and the integrity of the tool. So that's a fun new thing that I have coming up. But
yeah, you're really going for the food trucks, really, aren't you? There's always good food trucks at those kind of places.
I am. That's exactly it. In fact, I hope they come over and ask to get their knives sharpened, and then they turn around and bring back some food. That's really, I'm always, if you offer me food, it could be, you know, I've done some ridiculous things for some
for food,
for some slices of pizza and some beer.
Yeah.
Help people move their entire houses.
Yeah. No, that sounds fun. Yeah. Especially with summer coming as well, you know, getting out the fresh air as well. Sounds lots of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How about you? How's the past week been? You know, you got a new baby in the house.
I hate this bit of the show, because for me, it's always doom and gloom at the moment.
No, it's real life, man. It's real life.
But so chicken pox has come. The pox has reached us this week.
Oh, boy.
The twins are taken down with that. So they're off school. And we're obviously trying to, you know, keep the new baby from them. And, you know, you can imagine 3-year-olds and a new baby. They want it on its lap all the time. So. Yeah. Yeah, it's trying to split them up. Also trying to get this house in a reasonable shape. Now that we are in full time now, we're out of the other house.
Oh,
all our stuff is here in boxes all over the place.
Oh, does that stress you out?
You're
the kind of person that moves into a place and everything has to immediately be unpacked and in its place.
In my mind, that's what I want. I didn't realize until having kids that the thing that stresses me out more than anything else is like mess and untidiness.
Sure.
And it just makes it, weird, but it makes me tired, because I almost like give up. I'm just like, well what's the point?
Mentally fatiguing.
Exactly. And we find if we tidy a room, I sleep really, really well.
Sure.
But we're at that point again where everything is just back in boxes and back over to this new house. So it is quite stressful. But we have managed to get some shop time in, which is good.
Oh, that's good.
Not productive time, but set up time. So I've got this new shop. All my tools are now in. The electrics are all wired in. So today I was literally like bolting things down to counters and things like that. You know, this is literally the final countdown. So
I can't wait for you to do a tour. I remember seeing the tour of your pub. I hope sometime soon you'll be doing a tour of your new shop.
Of the workshop. It isn't impressive as the pub, unfortunately. I had all these grand ideas, but, you know, everything has come last to the house, really. So it's gonna be functional to begin with, and you know, from there we can work on things. So it's just one big open, where it's gonna be, you know, three different rooms. At the moment it's just one huge open space.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, we've got good ventilation in there, and we're, as we described last week, we're just literally sucking all the shit out and throwing it out the side of the house. So it, yeah, it's going to be a nice place to work. Nice, you know, big sort of volume, cavernous place, you know, really, really high ceilings and so on. So yeah. So I'm pretty stoked about that. So, yeah. It's all good. And we've had like summer today. I've been out in a t-shirt. I've been in the garden with the kids in a t-shirt. It's just like, yes, it just cheers everybody up, and it's fucking great.
That's
love
great.
It.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We've had the same actually recently. We've had a yesterday, and then a couple days prior were beautiful spring summer days, and that at around 65 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that means.
I think 17, 18, maybe. I think. Yeah.
Let's see. But, I'll just convert. It's 18. Yep. 18, so yeah, it was really nice, and all you want to do is just be in the sun.
Yeah. And everybody's happy. I mean, you see anybody, you know, even on the street, everybody's got a smile on their face. It's like, it's coming. Yeah, it's all good.
Don't worry, people are people, though. I'm sure people will start going back to being their shitty selves again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, shit bags will return. There's no point. Yeah,
grumpy.
No doubt.
We're all in, like, this euphoric period of coming out of the winter, and the sun's coming out, and everybody, you know, we have this shared experience of being kind of boxed up in our houses, but we'll get back
the blissful ignorance of a possible world war on its way as well. But hey,
right?
Hey, exactly. Today was a good day, so we'll go with that.
Exactly.
Okay. Have you? Knife Talk is spot.
Oh, sorry. Go for it.
I was just going to ask if you found a good spot for your even heat.
I have. Nicely shoehorned in there. I have actually. Yes. So the barn has got these huge, like, they're probably 2 foot thick. Stone walls. So the even heat is like in a corner of one of them, and the whole idea is it'll radiate a bit of heat out for me as well.
Sure.
In those winter months. But it's a really nice cool space for it. So yeah, it's all good. All good. And talking about even heat.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Even Heat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Oh, you could always go to knifetalk.net/heat and get money off. And why wouldn't you? So if you go to knifetalk.net/heat, that'll take you to Salt Ceramics, who are a distributor of Even Heats. You'll get $75 off, and you'll get free shipping in the US. And you can spec it out exactly as you would with Even Heat. So that's the way to do it. And, you know, whilst we're talking about shops and, you know, setting things up and that kind of thing, we can talk about Combat in just a second, because they're obviously sponsors of the show. But this sort of shoehorns in a bit too. I've got all my belts out of storage, and I didn't realize how many I'd sort of accumulated. I've got dozens and dozens and dozens. And it's like, how the fuck am I going to, you know, starting from scratch, this is an opportunity now to put these, you know, to sort these and, you know, have them nice. And, you know, the best thing I can come up with is just hooks on a wall. And I'm just like, I know what's going to happen. Within a few months, they're all going to be mixed up and there's going to be shit everywhere. So this is a shout out to anybody who has a good idea for storing belts, a system that works. I mean, I've tried drawers in the past, you know, and none of it seems to work. So, you know,
maybe the fresh belts hang on the wall, and partially used belts go on like a coat rack or something like that.
on the floor, usually. Yeah. You'd think, I don't know, somebody's got to come up with some sort of system which would help. But anyway, Combat are great. I've got lots of them. And whilst we're on the talking about belts.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers. Available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KnifeTalk15. Do it now.
Do it now. Shall we do some questions from the public?
Absolutely.
So these are all questions that will come via Instagram. So we are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. If you've got any questions, DM us there. And Robert Bozic. And he says, hi, guys. Love the podcast. It gets me through my week. The knowledge coupled with the humor is boomtown. So here's the question. My wife and I are selling our house and buying a fifth wheel RV. Wow. He says, I still want to make blades. Am I going to be able to in, I don't know what Koa Parks is, KOA Parks?
It's Campgrounds of America. Campground. Cleverly spelled wrong.
Ah, okay. Will you be able to in those parks with a propane forge? He says, I know coal will be looked at with Karen eyes. So switching to propane is going to be the only option. Any answers will be greatly appreciated. Much love to you all. Right, okay. So he's going to be working from a fifth wheel RV, right. And obviously a propane forge. Wow. What any other options he's got? He hasn't really got any other options, has he?
Yeah, I think a propane forge would probably be a smart move. But honestly, like, those campgrounds are like recreational parks, basically, where you park your recreational vehicle, your trailer, your RV or whatever. Hmm. But you're not really supposed to be doing like working on cars or building knives. I think if you can, I mean, this is honestly an idea that my wife and I had, was to get a travel trailer and haul around, because we have a pickup truck. So haul around my knife making stuff in the back of the pickup truck, park the trailer, but then find somebody, a knife maker in a certain location, who I could kind of work with or work at their property, and, you know, either learn from them or do a collaboration work with them. But that might be an option. But I'm guessing that they're not going to want you there for very long if you start grinding and throwing sparks.
It's
and
the noise, I think.
People are going there to relax, right?
Yeah. He's mentioning his forge. He hasn't mentioned his power hammer yet. That's a hell of a racket.
Right.
Jesus.
So, what is Boomtown? Is that from a show or something? What's Boomtown mean?
I don't know. I just think he means, yeah, it's really all good. Great. Yeah, I think. I don't know. I don't get you Americans. Americanisms.
Trust me, you guys have your sayings too.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But yeah, I don't know. I think you're going to have a hard time with that.
Yeah, it sounds like. But good luck. Good luck. Wow. Okay. Do you want to take the next one?
Yeah, this next one is from Captor Gingerbeard 3. He says, guys, quick question. I just made my first knife out of spring steel. How can I treat it to keep it from rusting? Thanks for the great work.
Congratulations, first of all, on your first knife.
Yeah.
Stop it from rusting. I mean, oiling is, you know, a classic. What do you think, Morocco?
You could dry it off. I mean, it's a novel idea, but keep it dry.
Keep it dry.
Keep it oiled good. Waxing is always a nice move, especially if it's a hard use knife, because I'm guessing this probably isn't a chef's knife out of spring steel. Yeah. Although you could make a chef's knife out of spring steel. So there are waxes. For culinary knives, I would use something like Axe Wax that is food safe wax. But if it's a hard use knife like a Bowie or a Hunter, I would use something along the lines of like Johnson's paste wax that actually creates a pretty surprisingly durable finish, and then either continue waxing it from time to time or just hit it with oil afterward. But yeah, those spring steels, especially if it's a recycled material, are not of the highest quality of, like, say it's 5160. There are actually different quality grades of 5160. There's knife steel grade, and then there's the stuff that goes underneath your car, and they are not the same. And so I think the lower grade or lower, I guess, purity that ends up in underneath the car for spring steels, while they could still make a decent tool, they have a stronger propensity for rusting.
Yeah. So. I'd also say don't be too hung up on it. I mean, sure, it's your first knife anyway, but, you know, maybe it's a case of you want to keep it, you know, because it's your first knife. So if that's the case, maybe get a sheath or make a sheath, oil it, and, you know, it'll store beautifully.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if it's a knife to be used, use it, you know.
Let it get a little shitty. Yeah. I actually don't mind that. As long as it's still cutting, whatever.
Yeah.
Personally,
yeah. If it's a knife that I'm using, I like it to be used. You know, I want it to have the scars of that. But yeah, it's all preference. The next one is from J. Dayella, I think it is.
Sure.
Question for Knife Talk. If your shop burned down and you had a blank slate, would you stick it out with knife making and rebuild the shop, or would you take the insurance and run? Or he says, if a shop burned down, what's the first thing you would get to rebuild, and what's something you'd be happy is gone? And Jeff is actually live from the awards. He's put a note here that I think this guy's shop actually burned down.
Oh, Christ.
Which is fucking terrible. It's so scary. Oh, man, I feel for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, if your shop's burned down, you had a blank slate. First, well, okay, let's take this in stages, Mareko. Okay. Would you stick it out, or would you take the money from insurance and run like fuck?
Will they give you the money if you don't reinvest it? I guess they probably should. But yeah, I would. I mean, like I think I've mentioned before, I don't really have much else to fall back on. Before I was making knives, I was washing dishes and prepping in restaurants and kitchens, so that's not exactly what I want to go back to from where I'm at currently. So I would stick with it. Would you?
Yeah, I would. And to be, even if money wasn't, you know, even if I didn't have to work, I think I would. And I've noticed that massively over the last sort of 6 months. But you know, we've moved twice now the last 6 months, and obviously having new children as well. I find if I'm not making something, I get irritable as shit.
Sure.
So if I was just at home with money to burn, with nothing to do, I'd be miserable as hell. I'd need to be making something. So yeah, I certainly would be. Maybe the pressure would be off, and maybe I'd make slightly different stuff. But yeah, I definitely still would be, without a doubt.
You know, honestly, I feel like a lot of people think that the goal in life is to make enough money so you don't have to do anything. But I think the reality is humans as an animal and a species, we need that sense of achievement, of accomplishment in our lives, whatever it is. So I think it's actually very rare that any person actually takes pleasure from literally laying around and doing nothing, because I think even science proves that, you know, the less connected you are with community and less you actually do or feel like a sense of accomplishment from, the shorter your life actually is. You survive better as a human animal through doing work and accomplishing things, especially if it's work that gives you a sense of fulfillment. And
I think particularly if you're a creative person, and I think we certainly, and I think most people who are listening, you're makers, you certainly are creative. I'm sure there are some people who'd be happy just shopping the rest of their life, but fuck them. Jesus. Jesus. Okay, where's the second part of this question?
Yeah.
Okay, your shop burned down. What's the first thing you would get to rebuild, and what's something that you'd be happy is gone?
Ooh, something happy is gone. Is gone. Oh, I know I'd be happy is gone. You were talking earlier about how you guys just moved in and you have everything in boxes all over the place and it's stressing you out. I think actually part of my stress and anxiety in my day-to-day work is just the fact that I have so much excess shit in my shop because it's become it doubles as a storage facility, that it actually hinders my sense of being able to be productive and heightens my sense of anxiety and stress. So if a lot of that shit burned up and was no longer there, I'd be totally fine with that. But where would I start in rebuilding? I think I would definitely get in my even heat, but also, I built my first grinder, and if I was smarter than I was then, I would definitely get a Broadbeck, because with a Broadbeck machine, you can have literally multiple machines in one with the various tool arms that they offer. And so that would be a big investment, but I also think it would be the right investment because your money will go a lot farther when you're buying the various attachment arms versus like multiple machines, especially I don't need massive machines. And I know there are some makers who, covet and collect them. And I think the history and stuff's really cool, but I honestly just don't have the space for all that stuff. I almost said crap. but
Chris Sapp just turned off.
Shit. So yeah, I think a good grinder and a good heat treating kiln would be a strong start in getting going in knife making again after a burn.
Yeah. One thing I'd be happy is, I've been just giving this some thought, and I think one thing that used to bug me like more than it really should have in the old shop is we had wooden floors, and they'd have these cracks along each sort of stave of the wood, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to sweep up and the dust would just go everywhere.
Sure.
And I didn't realize it bugged me as much as it did until we've just got like aluminium checker plate in the new shop. And sweeping up is just like the joy it gives. It's just like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So if I was building again from the ground up, you know, things just to make things simple.
Sure.
And as simple as that sounds, having a flat floor without cracks everywhere, it makes a massive difference. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And first thing I'd rebuild is I'd just be really happy which is what I'm doing at the moment, putting all the machines in, bolting them all down, because at that point, everything is perfect and as you want it. 1 week later, everything goes to shit and everything's a mess. And I'm the worst at getting myself back into things when things are a mess. I can I can just say, oh, I need to clean this up. I can spend a day cleaning up a little corner or something.
Sure.
If I had somebody, like, we've been talking about, you know, especially with Jeff as well, you know, at the moment, employing people and getting extra help, that kind of thing. I think I would be far more productive if I had a cleaner come into my shop for 3 hours a day than I would have another maker come into my shop for 3 hours a day.
Sure.
Seriously, honestly, when everything's clean, it's just, you just feel a bit more inspired to work and you know, you're excited.
Absolutely. Well, and that's why I'm saying, like, some of my stress and anxiety in my day to day is just like the mess that is there in their shop.
Yeah.
I feel you 100%. I mean, that's kind of what Neil Kamimura's got going on. He's hired his son to be his apprentice, but also, you know, part of that job is just making sure the shop is staying clean.
Yeah.
And, I feel like 100%. I would be a lot more productive if that was one less thing. Because honestly, like, you know, I know there are some people who take pleasure in some of those activities. But when more and more these days, when I'm in the shop, I'm trying to be productive and my time is better spent doing things, that only I can do rather than sweeping the floor and reorganizing things.
Yeah. It could be like a barber shop. You could just have somebody following you around with a brush, just sweeping up behind you. Be great.
Yeah.
Be great. Okay. Let's go on to the next one. Okay. Campbell Sharp Welding. Said, I've been listening to the podcast for a few weeks and you've made me really question using any wood that's not stabilized. I've got plenty of wood and want to get into stabilizing. So what would you suggest for me to get? Also, what are your favorite synthetic handle materials? I appreciate it. So he wants to get into stabilizing. Okay. You don't do any stabilizing yourself. Do you
I definitely do not, but there are places that offer the service.
Yeah.
But actually, one of our sponsors sells cactus juice, Maritime Knife Supply.
Yes. So if you're in Canada, Maritime Knife Supply, they sell that as well as lots of other stuff for knife makers. Go have a look. There's lots and lots of stuff there. One-stop shop for knife makers. And they also do combat abrasives as well. And I know they've got a deal. If you buy 10, you get 10% off and all this kind of stuff. But just go take a look. It's worth it if you're in Canada. They also ship to US as well. Stabilizing, getting into stabilizing, it doesn't need to be that expensive. And just before we come online, I was trying to find the make of the stuff that I use. I can't find it. But what I do find is the most expensive bit are the consumables, such as the resins and so on that you use.
Sure.
But if you get a vacuum pump and some sort of sealable container, and if you look on Amazon or anything, I mean, there's loads there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're all the same brand. They've all got the orange seals, and most of them using the same vacuum pump, which is like an orange thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they're just Chinese things rebranded. I've gone through maybe three of them five years, simply because I don't stabilize that often. And when you don't, they sort of gum up a bit, you know? They need a good clean. It doesn't need to be that expensive. I'd imagine, I don't know, I think you're in the US, you know, $200, you get yourself something decent enough do wooden handles.
Right.
What I find is the consumables are probably the most... I mean, cactus juice, everybody sort of uses, is well known.
Yeah.
I've started using like a plant-based resin, so it doesn't have all the nasties in there.
Okay.
Which is quite nice. But again, it can be quite expensive. And there's third-party places that you can send them as well. So there's lots of... you know, options available to you.
Sure.
If you just look at stabilizing kits on Amazon or, you know, there's loads. And they're all, I'm pretty much sure they're all the same, just rebranded.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I've had lots of handle material stabilized. I usually send it out to, like, KNG down in Arizona. Mm. They do a really great job. There are various, it's, at least here in the United States, there's at least two or three different companies. But there's so many people... And I thought I wanted to get into it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to save so much money, but I realized that I'm spending so much time with, you know, procuring the wood and breaking it down and letting, well, you don't have to do much when you're letting it season, but when you get into the stabilizing process, there's a lot involved with that, and I'm just like, this isn't what I'm not passionate about stabilizing wood. Why the fuck am I thinking I want to try to do this? I'll just let the people who are good at it do it. And I'll support them.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah. You do what you're best at and let others do what they're best at. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead.
Do you have more you want to add to it?
No. You go for it.
Okay. This next one is from Brandon Ulick. He says...
No, Ulick.
Can't remember if I've asked this before or not. But why do some 2x72-inch belts have directional arrows and others do not? Do you know the answer?
Well, I think it's due to the tape that sort of joins the belt. So if you use a belt for a fair bit, you take it off, then you put the belt back on, it sometimes can give you a bit more of a bump on the tape. But to be honest with you, it doesn't bother me. I find that if I use a belt for a while... and then turn it the other way, it can give you an extra little bit of grit.
Sure.
I'm not quite sure why they have them, but I generally try to keep, you know, the direction the same all the time. But then just at the end, I maybe get an extra 10% out at the end by turning them around.
Yeah.
But I'm always extra careful then because I think the seam could be maybe slightly
just
weaker,
hit them from the backside, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure why. That's my answer to that. But
I think it actually comes down to, so I think abrasive companies, some make the giant rolls that, like if you go on Combat's Instagram, you can see the giant rolls of abrasive that they then make the belts out of. They cut them obviously to various widths as well as lengths depending on the application, but. Some of the companies that make those abrasives also make their own belts. But I think it's the directional arrows are based on the actual construction technique for the belts. So if you go on Combat's Instagram, you can see that they are assembling the belts where the seam or is kind of at an angle, but they butt them up edge to edge. And then they put a tape underneath that completes the belt. But there's another belt making technique where they actually, instead of butting them edge to edge, they remove some of the abrasive off of one of the edges of the belt, and then they do a lap joint. And based on that lap joint and how it overlaps, they have the direction you want the arrows to be going in the proper direction so that that lap joint is going in the right direction. Because if you go run it in the opposite, the chances of accidentally blowing up that belt, basically, or ruining that lap joint are very high. But I have found that belts that are assembled in that way are not very fun to grind with because of that lap joint, and especially in a heavier weight belt, it creates a really big bump. And even in J-Flex, I've experienced belts that are even J-Flex with that lap joint assembly style, and that also bumps really bad too, and it's not great, honestly. It kind of sucks to use. And so my preferred belts are edge to edge or kind of butted up against each other and then with the tape underneath. And Combat does it that style, and I think it's great, honestly. I really like it a lot.
There we go.
For a smooth grind.
Fabian has asked again on Instagram, I have a question for you. What was the point in time when you felt comfortable to charge customers for your knives the amount of money so that you can run a profitable business? I've been making knives for about 5 years and now would like to finance myself besides university. Please ask for tips on pricing for beginners would be much appreciated. Keep up the good work. So, okay, so Fabian is he's in university, but he'd like to finance himself through university with his knife making. So he's wondering how he can go about start. By the sounds of things, he hasn't been charging much for knives, and now he wants to make it profitable for him.
Sure.
Any tips for that?
I mean, honestly, until you've developed a decent reputation or strength of brand, it's hard to charge too much because nobody knows who you are and why would they spend money with you. But I think one great tool that many of us have at our fingertips is literally our phones and using Instagram and social media to work on kind of developing that brand and reputation. And it honestly costs you your time. It doesn't cost anything to use Instagram. It just costs you your time. But we've had people asking questions about in the past few weeks. You know, I'm inundated with custom orders. What do I do? I think that's when you are overwhelmed by orders, that is when you are in a position to use a simple economic principle of supply and demand and start pushing up your prices. And that will slow down the number, or I guess it kind of, I don't know, if you look at it like a faucet on a hose. You're kind of just snugging up the faucet, basically, a little bit. People are still going to be saying yes, or they're just going to be the ones who are willing to pay more or can afford to pay more. The sad and unfortunate and realistic thing is, like, you can't afford, especially if you're going to run a sustainable business, you got to be able to pay for yourself and your life and the effort and energy and skill you put into these knives. And unfortunately, the reality is there aren't in the scope of the entire world, there aren't that many people with the skills to make high quality handcrafted knives. And being such a niche skill, if you've built the reputation and you have the skill, you deserve to be compensated for that. And that's not necessarily what everybody's willing to pay for, especially if they're just, if they see it in a knife shop where there's like a $50 knife and then they see your $500 or $600 or $800 knife, all they see is the price difference. But once you've built that kind of brand recognition, that reputation, then people are buying the knives not just based on the price point, but because of who you are and what your reputation represents in the quality of the tool that you are making.
Yeah. 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 Like you said, we've all had these tools available to us to sort of weave a sort of story around what we're doing. And people lap that stuff up as well. They love the whole, this maker is crafting this kind of thing. We all know we could go to a store and buy a $50 to $100 knife. That would be a great, great knife. But you're not selling the knife. You're selling more than that. You're selling, your experience, your work, the whole story around it and the fact that it is handmade. Get comfortable with selling yourself, which, so many knife makers aren't. Unfortunately, you need to. You need to because there is a community online of people who buy knives, that kind of thing. And there is, as much as, like Mareko said, it's a very niche thing. If people get into that sort of community, all of a sudden there's a lot of choice. Be comfortable with selling yourself and finding what works for you. And I'm sure you'll find an audience. But, personally, for me, it was that transition to, you know, making it into profitable business was very sort of organic, really. It was a sort of a side thing for me, sort of. I'm sure it's for everybody. Nobody just wakes up one morning and says, right, I'm going to be a profitable knife maker. It's a side thing. It's you know, maybe a hobby, and you start enjoying it, and you start selling to, you know, family, friends, then more and more people hear about it, and more people are buying. And there comes a point where, as Mareko said, where you need to cover your costs and make that decision, right, then this is what I'm going to be doing. My costs need to be covered. I need to not only cover my costs, but actually make a living out of this as well, and, you know, be able to pay bills and be able to have a life out of it as well. So it is difficult, and for most, it's a slow burner.
Sure.
So yeah, just get comfortable selling yourself, selling your story, finding out what's unique about your knives, and yeah, keep on grinding, and I'm sure it'll come.
Well, and to add to your what you're saying, I honestly don't think a slow burn is a bad thing. I think a lot of people they want to get into knives and then within a year be really well known and sell their knives for lots of money. And that, I mean, obviously that would be cool and great, but by starting small and building up over time, you get to take, you get to build potentially a grassroots following that has followed your journey all along the way, and they get to be the people who, you know, when you first started out, they bought a knife from you for a couple $100 that now is maybe a couple $1,000, you know, who knows where it goes. But additionally, another way to build reputation and kind of like awareness of your work, especially if you're doing quality work, but maybe you struggle with doing the social media aspect, it might make sense for you to work with a purveyor, especially if you're doing good work, because that's kind of they take a cut, but they're also doing kind of the business and advertising, and because they already have an established collector base, they have the reputation and the respect that they know what to find. It's almost kind of like a gallerist in a way, which I feel like Jeff would maybe potentially be against, but when in
fuck Jeff, he's not even here, he couldn't even show up today.
Fuck you, Jesus. Jeff, by the way, thanks for not showing up. Have fun at your gala or your award show and fancy drinks and stuff,
you rhinestone cowboy. Yeah.
but I think, you know, and honestly, that's kind of how I started. When I first started, nobody knew who I was. Even though I had worked for a very a maker, Bob Kramer, who had a massive reputation, nobody knew who I was. And so, but I was doing good work. And so I got started by working with a purveyor of knives. And you know, they did take a cut because they also need, if they're selling retail, they need to have some sort of markup. Otherwise, their business isn't sustainable. But they helped establish me as a quality maker and a quality product. And then my reputation started to build up from there. And then I was able to kind of pivot that into doing my own promotion and building my own kind of brand and social media following through Instagram. And then more and more people start to see you and recognize your work is good stuff. And, you know, you never know who's going to be that one that buys your stuff and then you just blow up. Right. So that could be, I mean, a perfect example are of purveyors who, especially in culinary knives, who do a really great job of promoting makers are like Abe Shaw at Eating Tools. He sells like Charlie Ellis's work and Joshua Prince's work and Nick Anger. And so, and some of those people, maybe they're not necessarily the greatest at presenting themselves on social media or that's just, you know, that's just not their thing. But by working with somebody, it's kind of like Jeff, honestly, it's kind of like Jeff having a business partner. And I think that's the way to really realistically look at it. If you establish one of these relationships with a purveyor, look at them as a business partner. Yes, they get their cut, but they're also doing a part of the business that maybe you're not the best at or even want to do.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Or another option is to do something very different to what others are doing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, really sort of stand out.
Sure.
So your stuff does jump out. And You know, you could be using Dharma steel to make some sort of fabulous stuff. That's really going to sort of be very sort of bling.
It's the way of the future.
It is. If you don't know what Dharma steel is, it's a stainless Damascus, or layered steel, which looks fantastic. They've got some amazing patterns and so on. Go take a look at Dharma Steel Lab on Instagram, and you'll see what I mean. People make beautiful, beautiful sort of one-offs with this stuff. It's beautiful. And if you go to dharmasteel.se and register as a customer, you'll get 10% off using Knife Talk as well. But yeah, I mean, that's one way to stand out by using stuff that will really sort of jump out to sort of high-end stuff that, you know, people don't see every day. It's all about finding your thing, I think. And, you know, you see lots of people who are just starting out and they may be doing culinary knives, maybe doing camp knives as well, all sorts of knives. And I think you're sort of diluting your pool, I think, doing that way. You know, find what you want to be doing and really sort of double down on that. That's what I'd say.
Absolutely.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place by working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies. We keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Absolutely.
Where are we? Holger Wisbel. Do you want to take that one?
Holger Wisbel. I feel like that is like a video game character from like Fable or something, like one of those.
Yeah,
RPGs.
Or from Lord of the Rings or something. Yeah.
Oh, actually, did you see that a whole new, like, somebody discovered a sketchbook or something of J.R.R. Tolkien's that had never been seen before? These illustrations for like the Lord of the Rings series and stuff.
Oh, wow. No.
That's super cool.
And to be honest, I'm not into that kind of stuff at all, to be honest with you.
Lame. You're lame. I'm
a grown man. I'm a grown man. I don't believe in goblins.
Oh, yeah. What was that last week you were talking about? You don't do cartoons or comic books?
No. I've got this weird thing with like... not fiction, but like fantasy. You know, it's like, well, that's not fucking
real. What about Star Wars?
Even as a kid with Star Wars, I was just like, no way.
Okay, I'll see you later. I'm hanging up right now. See you there.
Wasn't having it at all. I know. I think I'm the weirdo there. I'm the odd one out, to be honest with you. Yeah. Anyway, Holger Wisbol from Middle Earth has asked.
Do you want to do it or you want me to?
No, you go for it.
Okay, do any of you guys know how to use a draw knife? I'd like to know if there are if they are supposed to be used bevel side up, bevel side down, or if it's just a matter of preference. Also, weird customer request. A friend, colleague, and technically also customer asked me, do you think you could get that thing out? I had accidentally just put my work knife through his hand.
Oh, holy shit. That's a very like calm, a hey, do you think you could just remove that knife from me? Jesus, wow.
By the way, could you do me a solid?
Jesus Christ. Holger, what are you up to? What are we talking about? Draw knives. This
was probably fantasizing he was in Middle Earth fighting orcs.
That's what it was.
No, I'm just joking. Sorry, Holger.
Bevel side up or bevel side down. I don't use them. I have used them, and I'm pretty sure you'd want bevel side up.
Mm.
If I'm right in thinking a draw knife is where you sit and you draw it towards you.
Handle on either side.
For shaving bark off and that kind of stuff. I'd see it as bevel side up. If you've got bevel side down, it's always going to want to ride up and possibly be dangerous and the blade comes straight towards your throat.
See, I think...
No, sorry, you go on. I may be wrong, but I'd imagine bevel side up for that reason. You don't want it riding up. You want to shave.
I would assume that you want it. I've never used one. I've seen Liam Hoffman use it to rip axe handles through hickory. Yeah. It's fucking wild because he's going fast. But I would assume that it's bevel side down. So flat, the flat side's facing up towards the sky with the bevel on the backside so that you can kind of do scooping cuts. Because if it's bevel side up, if you start digging into the wood, the only way to come back out is by backing the blade up rather than pulling it up. Kind of in a scooping action.
Yeah.
But I honestly have never used one as well.
I think it would just be very difficult to do it the other way with the bevel side up.
That's why it's a skill.
Certainly is a skill, yeah. And you can see Holger and his orc friends in the woods whittling some furniture.
Chopping
with
down
their drawn
trees
arms.
Around Isengard and building scaffolding for the orcs to melt steel and... Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So the answer is we don't know, Holger. Holger. We don't know. We have different opinions, actually. So, yeah, we don't know, I'm afraid.
Sorry.
Okay, Trevor Warrow. Hey, guys. TW Knives here. I have a heat treat question for you. On a 416 stainless steel and a 1084 Sanmite billet, is it okay to heat treat the profiled blade before grinding the bevels to expose the 1084? That's what I did and seemed to provide me a nice hard blade. After, I was worried that the stainless on the outside would act like the clay, like when you're trying to get a ham on, affected the heat treat of the core steel. And he says it was heat treated and tempered at 1084 temperatures, for your information. Sorry for the wordy question. You guys are awesome. Thanks for all you do. That's miraculous. That's got you written all over that one.
I mean, I wouldn't be concerned. If anything, once the steel comes up to temperature, I see what he's saying. Because heat transfers through stainless very differently than it does through carbon steel. And so if it transfers through the stainless slower, it's potentially keeping that core hot longer. But if you are working with Sanmai, that's maybe 3 mil, around 200,000s, 180,000s, then... You should be able to harden the entire thing in a pretty reasonable amount of time. My concern, honestly, would be that the core material would become overexposed, especially if you heat treated it flat, like a flat bar stock, and then stock removed from there. And usually the goal with a lot of Sanmai is for there to be a very small core reveal along the edge. So that is the... I guess it's not that doesn't have to do with the heat treat, but overall kind of Sanmai generality. But I think as long as it's thin enough, it shouldn't be a problem. If it's really thick, like a quarter of an inch thick, which is about 5 mil, then you might have some issues for sure. But no, not if it's thinner, around 3 mil or 180,000s or so. It should be totally fine.
Quarter inch is 6.35 mil.
Oh, jeez. Okay, I was way off. Sorry.
It's close enough. Close enough.
So sorry.
Where are we? Kaz asks, hey, man, I have a question. It's another heat treat question, actually. What is a good reason to pre-grind before heat treat? And they say they use 01, deep hardening and soaking a kiln. Hardening finished profiles and grinding afterwards is quicker and avoids decarb and warping. I personally couldn't agree more. It's exactly what I do.
Sure.
I think it depends on what style you're making. If you're making, you know, a thin culinary knife, I think it makes huge sense to do that because, you know, as you say, you're not avoiding, but you're sort of certainly lessening the risk of warping, that kind of thing. And personally, I prefer to grind a hardened steel. It feels a little different to
grind hard.
I do like to grind hard.
Hard steel between your hands. Yeah.
It does feel different to a soft steel. You know, I can imagine if you're doing something thick, maybe you might want to take a little bit off beforehand. But I don't, you know, I don't do anything really that thick anyway. So I always prefer to fully heat treat, then just grind carefully afterwards.
Yeah. You're all about the friction. Not the French. Oh, have you done heat treated a lot of 01? I actually haven't myself.
I did that when I first started. That all my knives were 01, okay. And they were chef knives.
Right.
Yeah.
How thick were they?
They were probably 3 mil the thickest.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, so I've never done anything that thick, really. And to be honest, my first knives, four chef knives, were thick. Yeah, I've always just found it easier to heat treat first.
Sure.
Because when I do heat treating in batches specifically, once they're heat treated, I'll then clamp them all together as one sort of big brick, and then temper everything in together. Where if they're ground, you're gonna have edges and you're gonna have different angles, that kind of thing would never really work. So if there is any slight warping after heat treat, when I clamp them all together with, I use 1/4-inch plates either side as well, that will really just, help to straighten anything out if it's not perfect.
I personally have never heat treated in anything full thickness at the edge. I always pre-grind, especially wear-resistant steels like 01, W2, 52-100 even. It's just because it can be a lot of work to grind after, especially if you are doing a thicker blade. It could be a lot of work, a lot of abrasives, and a lot of time, just like a lot of time at the grinder, just to get it down. I've found that by doing a subcritical anneal before my final hardening helps reduce to basically completely avoiding any kind of warps in a blade that has been pre-ground. And you can learn more about that from Dr. Laren Thomas's knife steel engineering, is it knife steel engineering? Knife blade engineering?
Knife steel engineering, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
About how that subcritical anneal or temper anneal is what he calls it sometimes as well, where basically you are over tempering from a martensitic structure. So you fully harden the blade, then you bring it back up to like 1200, 1250 degrees, and then you temper it for about an hour, and then you do your final hardening from there. Or you do some machining and then do your final hardening from there. But I almost never have warping issues when I do that process. And that way I get to grind the blade basically completely soft, which saved me a lot of time and effort at the machine. And then I go into my final heat treat and it comes out great. But it also, some people have different limitations on what they can achieve in their shops, whether they have a temperature control kiln versus doing a forge. That will very definitely limit your ability to do a temper anneal like that.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
So I suppose, again, we differ on opinions there, but there's no right or wrong way, I suppose, that's what we're trying to say.
Sure.
And
if the material's thin enough, like closer to an eighth of an inch thick, sure. Harden full thickness all day and then grind from there. That would be a dream, honestly. Mm. But if it's thicker, like around 200 thousandths of an inch, I would definitely do some pre-grinding before my heat treat. Something like that.
Gotcha. Okay, I want to tell everybody about Texas Farrier Supply. They've been a sponsor of the show for a long, long time. And they're great, again, one of those one-stop shops where you can go and buy everything that you need if you're a knife maker. But one of the really cool things is that they sell Indasa RhinoWet, which we all love. So when it comes to hand sanding, which is the bit we all hate, it makes sense to do it with the best stuff. So it's RhinoWet by Indasa. It's going to save you time and money, and it just I wouldn't say it makes it a joy hand sending, but it makes it less of a horrible chore.
Sure.
If you're looking to lighten the load when it comes to hand sanding, you want RhinoWet by Indasa. It's the best place, it's the best stuff, and they sell it at, as I say, texasfiresupply.com. If you use Knife Talk 10, you'll also get 10% off your order there as well. So go take a look. Fill up your basket with Indasa RhinoWet, but have a good look around the store. They've got lots of stuff that you may not even know that you need as a knife maker to make your life that little bit much easier. Go take a look. Okay, we're rattling through questions. Do you want to take the next one, Marika?
Absolutely. It is from Paul Jansen. He says, excuse me. I got a question, probably more for Mareko. I started making Damascus and Sanmai, but don't know how to finish the handles. I've always glued the handle and then shaped it, but now I'm grinding the finish off. I've tried the Q-tip dipped in acid, and it didn't work for me. Is there a better way to get the handle on and shaped and still keep the pattern? Okay, so it sounds like they're making knives out of Damascus, but they're probably non-integral, but with a full tang. And he's etching it, but then sculpting the handle, and it's taking the pattern off. And so something we've talked about in the past is to use dummy pins. So basically, they temporarily affix the handle scales to the blade so you can do your handle sculpting. And then you take them off, you etch your blade, whatever finish you're going for, then do your final glue up. Use paste wax or be handy with the acetone or ready with the acetone to clean off any excess glue. And so, and then in the final glue up, you're using full on Corby bolts, and that's, and then once it's set and ready to roll, whether it's overnight or after about half an hour, then you can trim those Corby bolts or grind them off. And all you have to do, at that point, you won't have to do any cleaning along the spine and the bellies. Ideally, you're just hitting those pins or those bolts, again, whether they're Colby bolts or eighth inch pins or whatever you got. And you don't have to touch up, hit the spine at all. You're just cleaning up those pins and finishing those out, and you should be in a good spot.
There we go. So if you're not sure what we mean by hidden pins, let's say you're using Corby bolts, just cut them a bit shorter.
Right. Sorry.
Use something like a Dremel or maybe even a file, and file a slot in there so you can unscrew them later. Finish the knife, take them off. As Mareko just explained.
Yeah. What I've done with the with Corby's, like the set of dummy pins that I have, I before even trimming them, I actually just bolted the set together and then ran it down my porter bandsaw and cut and took the slot for the flathead screwdriver, and I just pushed it basically almost all the way down, and then I trimmed it. That way I didn't have to like guess where middle was again, and I did that from both sides, and then hit it with a file to open it up maybe a little bit if you need to. Otherwise, just get a nice thin tipped flathead screwdriver. You just need it on there tight enough to just hold things together while you sculpt the handle and then take them off.
There we go.
That's it.
There we go.
That's it.
This next one, I've just sort of pre-read it, and I think Dave has got to be the greatest salesman in the world.
Okay, I can't wait.
Just listen to this for a first line. I am not a knife maker, but I've been asked to give a private knife class to a guy as a surprise by his wife. So I'm not quite sure what's going on and how that come about.
So,
not a knife maker, but I've been asked to give a private knife class to a guy as a surprise by his wife. And he says, I've never given classes. It's a new friend. So I imagine it would only be a casual, but I feel the pressure to be professional and quality since she wants to pay. I think this guy's been bullshitting a little, hasn't he? He's been telling everybody he's the world's greatest knife maker. They said, well, come and do a class. And he's like, oh, fuck. He said, could be just a fun day forging knives. Not really a question, but I guess a topic of discussion. Thanks, guys. I'm a little confused by that first line. I'm not a knife maker, but I've been asked to give a private knife class to a guy.
My guess is it's somebody who dabbles or as a hobbyist. But somehow has been presented as a knife maker, and so this other guy is like, oh, you should teach my husband a class. For me personally, if I was in that position, I'd be like, especially if they're like, it sounds like they're neighborhood friends or whatever, or casual friends.
Yeah, well, it's a new friend. It says it's a new friend, so I imagine it would only be casual.
I would just be like, Why doesn't he just bring some beers over? We'll hang out and, hit some steel or grind on some steel. But I wouldn't feel comfortable. I, I've been making knives for almost 9 years, and I don't feel comfortable teaching classes, honestly. Yeah. I've just, in this last year, really started to take the idea of teaching classes more seriously. So
I've got another take on this. So okay, let's hear just it. Reading through it again, it says, it's a new friend, so I imagine it only be casual. And this is by the wife, remember. I think they're fucking swingers. I think she's saying, come on round, bring your tools, and it'll be that whole, oh, there's a knock on the door, who could this possibly be? And they're at it, you know? And I think that's what's going on, Dave. Be very wary. That's all I'm saying.
It sounds like the start of a very low budget pornography.
It does. Sorry, Dave.
Maybe it's going to be great for you, Dave. Who knows?
Maybe. Yeah. Dylan Wesk, I think that's how you pronounce it, as just said, I've been having trouble etching my Damascus and San Mai. The 15N20 continues to come out dark and or blotchy. I've taken it up to 1500 grit. Maybe my acid mix is too strong or at 4 parts water and 1 part ferric. Mm-hmm. So what do you think, Mareko? Trouble etching?
Yeah. So 15 and 20 can pick up staining very easily. One, if the lines of the 15 and 20 in whatever pattern you got are too bold, bolder than about an eighth of an inch, they will start picking up coloring in both ferric as well as coffee. There's something about that just being too much of a gap of material to keep it bright. So if you're designing or making a pattern, try to think about how bold are these lines going to be, because if they're too bold, the 15 and 20 is probably going to pick up coloring that I don't want it to pick up. The other thing I've experienced is that if you, great, good for you taking it up to 1500 grit. I think that is definitely not necessary. I actually personally only hand sand my Damascus up to 800 grit, and kind of an industry standard is 400 grit. And if you burnish the surface of your material, whether you're at 400 grit or you're at 1500 grit, you're kind of closing the surface. So instead of having fresh abrasive that cuts and is removing material, it's instead burnishing or smearing that surface. I think of it as like having a drink container or something with a lid on it, and if it's open, then stuff can the acid can etch and do its job properly. But if it's closed, funky stuff starts to happen. And you would think, just thinking about it, it would seem to make sense. Oh, if I close up that 15 and 20 surface by burnishing it and scrubbing it down really hard, it's not going to pick up color. But it actually picks up color more when it's a closed or burnished surface rather than being an open or freshly abraded surface. I don't know why. It just does. That is my experience. But again, I also think 1500 grit is a little bit overkill. It's great for monosteel knives, honestly, and that's kind of the downside of monosteel knives is that you kind of have to take them to a higher grit finish for them to look nice. Versus, I guess, Damascus is kind of hidden behind the etch of the pattern. But yeah, if you pull it back to maybe 600 or 800 grit and then try etching it again, you'll probably have a lot more success. And when you're pulling your final strokes, just make sure you're using fresh abrasive, not anything that's too worn down or, crushed through. And you should have a nice open surface that the acid will be able to etch properly. I know it sounds completely counterintuitive to have a more open surface or even a coarser grit to get a nice high contrast. But honestly, some of the best coffee finishes I've ever got were when I was test etching a blade after finish grinding off the machine at 220 grit. I put it in the coffee overnight, come back the next day, and it's popping, extremely high contrast, pitch black and silver. But obviously you can't leave, your fancy, nice Damascus knife at 220 grit finish. So you got to pull it up a little bit. But yeah, that's why I like, you know, I usually scrub really hard up to 400 grit, and then I pull strokes at 400. And then instead of scrubbing at 600, I pull strokes. I follow those 400 strokes with 600 grit strokes, and then I finish with 800 grit strokes. So I'm not even really scrubbing at 600, 800. I'm only just trying to refine the sanding grits from 400.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Well, I'll take this next one from Mark LeBlanc. If you want to look down the list for a nice juicy one we can finish up with.
Sure.
So this is from Mark LeBlanc, again, on Facebook. On Instagram. And he says, when sharpening by hand, what stones do you use or recommend? He said, I'm not sure, but I think you already got this question. So I don't sharpen by hand. I use a Tormek, which I have done for years and years now. And I'm just trying to think what the stones are. So I use the standard stone that comes with the Tormek. So you have like a dressing tool with it. So I believe they're probably around about 600. And then when you dress it, it dresses to about 1200, I think. But then I've also got the white wheel, which is like a finishing wheel, which I believe is 2000 grit. And I've used them for years, and I'm just into that, so I don't really do any sort of hand. Well, I suppose this is hand sharpening, but you're using like a water wheel at the same time. Sure. But so I believe they are 600, 1200, and then I say 2000, or it may possibly even be 2500 for that white wheel at the very end. Hand sharpening. Do you do any at all?
Sorry. I was looking down the list.
Sorry, I know. I did say look down the list. And then,
Okay. Yes. When sharpening by hand. Okay. So I used to do a lot more sharpening by hand. I had a King stone, which is actually a pretty affordable stone to get a hold of. Last I looked, it was about $50 or $60 for about a 2-inch wide by 8-inch long combination stone of 1,000 and 6,000 grit. And I actually still have that stone. I just don't really use it anymore. I have a new stone. It's an Ardennes Belgian blue stone. They're actually quarried in Belgium, and they're beautiful stones. They're kind of a 4,000 grit stone, but they also have these tiny little garnets in them. So you're getting a 4,000 grit finish, but you're also getting a mixture. It's not completely 4,000. It's kind of
a bit of abrasion,
mixture of abrasion, and it creates some of the craziest sharp cutting edges I've ever hand sharpened. And these the Belgian blue stones, the Ardennes, are they're sold as razor stone for sharpening like straight razors on, but they are killer for chef's knives. For a long time I lived and died by that 1,000 6,000, and what I would do is I would start on the 1,000 to establish the geometry, and then I'd flip the stone over and I'd have a Nagura stone, which is kind of a little abrasive stone to kind of create a slurry we were talking about the other day, kind of a mixture of loose abrasive and stone, and helps get a really nice high, like super fine polish, like almost mirror. But then I would go back to the 1,000 grit side, and I'd reintroduce some 1,000 grit scratches by just doing some light stropping, kind of backwards stropping motions, just a few times each side. Because for chef's knives, people get crazy and they think they want like a 10,000 grit finish, but that is absurd, honestly. And it's not functional because the micro serrations along that cutting edge are so they cut great initially, but then overuse, especially against a work surface, they're not going to last. And so it's about kind of by reintroducing those 1,000 grit scratches, you have a mixture of 1,000 and 6,000, and the 1,000 grit are going to be a little bit more stout, I guess, serrations along the fine cutting edge. And they will allow your knife to continue to cut more effectively and aggressively over time, and or between kind of honings or stroppings and sharpenings. And so I've definitely become a big fan of reintroducing coarse scratches after taking a knife up to a really high finish.
Interesting. Right. Okay. Nice. Nice. What did you come up with? Did you find anything interesting?
I'm just going to go with this. I was scrolling deep through the list, and I decided I'm just going to go with the next one, which is from Thirsty Works Knives. So it says, last week you talked a little about the value of a thin kitchen knife. I have now made a handful of kitchen knives, and I'm progressively getting more comfortable making them thinner. My first one is embarrassingly thick. What would you say is your ideal run-of-the-mill chef's knife spine thickness and profile length? Thanks for all the helpful content. What's your go-to thickness at the spine and length?
As she says, around sort of 2 mil for my spine thickness. Okay. And profile length, anything between sort of 5 and 7 inches, I suppose, depends on what sort of style of knife it is. But yeah, like you, my first knives were embarrassingly thick. I think I was like, my first like kitchen knives were like 4 mil thick, you know, on the spine, which you could use to batten firewood with, you know, if they were thick.
Right.
But yeah, anything from sort of, depending on the style and what you use for, anything between sort of 1.8 and 2.2 mil. Simply because they're sort of standard sizes that I can get sort of sheet form over here.
Sure. Wow. Yeah. That is, so in the Imperial systems, that is just over a 16th of an inch, which is, to me, seems incredibly thin.
Really? Right.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't advocate any specific blade thickness at the spine because I've encountered great knives that are super thick behind the spine, and also very thin knives that are, super thick knives that are thick at the spine but cut like a dream, but also very thin knives made from thin stock that cut like dog shit. It comes down to that edge geometry. Again, I feel like we've talked about this before, but everybody's so fixated on the spine, they forget about the part that's actually doing the cutting work, which is down at the cutting edge. And so you want to push your cutting edge and kind of the material, you know, maybe a centimeter or about a half an inch up from the cutting edge. You want to push that to more of the thinner side, because that is really going to dictate how your knife performs. Not how, because you're not cutting with the spine of the knife, you're cutting with the edge of the knife, right? And so I would focus on your edge geometry, because that's where all the performance is happening. And if you're not sure how thin you can take your material, I often tell people to push it too far. Basically, have one ready to basically destroy or not be sellable. Push it too far and then pull it back. Figure out where that, you're never going to know where that edge is, where you're just going to then fall off the cliff. And it's so thin that it doesn't hold an edge, even cutting through, you know, a pepper or something like that, because it's so thin, it's become a foil edge and it starts to deform ribbon or chip or whatever. So then pull it back and figure out where that is based on that material that you like to use and that actual that thickness. Once you pull it back, you know, I had one slicer I made out of some Damascus, and I'd never done any destruction and like really gnarly destruction testing. So I ground the knife like I would normally would, very thin, and then I chopped into antler with it, which is obviously knife abuse. That's not anything that it would ever actually do. It's not designed to do that work. But I was curious what that edge, that geometry of that knife would be able to handle, and I found that I could actually pull it back to about 20/1000ths of an inch thick, sharpen it, and then it would held up to chopping into an antler. Great. But I never would have known that if I hadn't done that. You see? I think the key is to understand your tools and what they're really capable of. You have to build some to destroy them to really understand what they're capable of. But again, when it comes to the thinness of the knife and how it performs, focus more on the edge geometry rather than the spine, because the edge is where the work's being done.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen you know, chef knives that people have done, and the grind is almost like a Scandi grind on it. It doesn't go anywhere near as high as the spine anyway on some knives.
Absolutely.
So you got to think, you know, it doesn't really make too much of a difference than what the spine is.
Sure.
But personally, mine basically taper from the spine all the way down, a solid taper all the way. But I'm talking a height of about 50 mil generally for one of my chef knives.
Right.
So you can sort of work out the angle. But yeah, as Mirko said, it completely depends on how that edge is ground, but, you know, more than anything else, I suppose. Yeah. Okay, I think we've rattled through dozens of, more than we've done in weeks there, so we've managed to cut down a lot of questions. We've still got hundreds on the list here to work our way through, but we'll get there eventually. So if you have sent us a question, please don't resend the same question. We do have a huge, like, mega list of questions, and Jeff does a lot of work every week of updating new ones and mixing them up a little bit as well. So yeah, no need to resend them, but we will get to all questions in time. But hey, thank you all for listening. We wish Jeff all the best at the award ceremony tonight. I Think I'm With You is a great song. His voice really compliments Kenny Rogers more than I thought it would.
Sure.
And maybe if you stick around after the after show, you may even hear a clip of one of Jeff's songs with Kenny Rogers. Who knows? Thank you all for listening. Bye for now.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
He wasn't even missed, was he? Let's face it.
He does offer a lot of dick joke quips, but...
He does. We were quite straight there. We went straight question.
We were railing him.
It was all good. All good. Look, did you manage to see the Bad Vegan that we talked about?
I have not watched it yet.
Oh, I know Jeff did see it this week, and he's like, fuck me, this woman's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And before, you know, rather than go into it too much, it's about this woman who had this restaurant in New York, and people were scammed. That's all I'll say. I won't say who and why and all the rest of it. But it turns out that she is now online, and she's telling, like, the real story, saying Netflix hasn't really told the full story and stuff, so that, like, more and more stuff's coming out now, and it's just like, oh wow, so it's like it turned into this huge drama.
Right.
It's good
I
stuff.
I feel like that's usually not the best course to take, or the direction to take, is to get up and start trying to defend yourself, because it usually just makes things worse for you.
Probably. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think she's a bit maybe fame hungry. This individual, but. Yeah, it's interesting stuff. It really is. Yeah. Really is. Trying to think, what else am I watching this week?
My wife and I started watching Alias, which is a series.
I think Amy watched that. Yeah,
it's a series. It's about a. Oh my god! Now I'm blanking on her name. But anyways, a woman who becomes a spy, and she, like, it's secret from everybody in her life, but then she slowly starts to learn that some of the people in her life actually know that she's a spy, and all are also spies, and just, like, her journey through being a double agent and all that stuff. And I didn't watch it when it originally came out because I thought it was just too cheesy, basically.
Yeah.
But watching it now, I was like, oh, it's definitely not the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. But it's actually pretty interesting and entertaining. And part of the reason we started watching it is my wife went on a trip over to Washington, D.C., and one of the museums, the many museums she went to, was the Spy Museum. So every once in a while, she'll pause and she'd be like, oh, at the museum, they said about this, like how long people have, like when they're shown information on paper, you have like 5 or 10 seconds to memorize it before they literally like set it on fire and destroy it.
Oh, wow.
And just like little things like that. And they put those into the show. So it's kind of neat to see
what
they're doing.
I didn't see it, but I know Amy watched it and she was well into it for a while. So,
it's got like 5 seasons.
Wow.
Like that. Go ahead.
I'm the worst for TV at the moment because when by the time like the twins go to bed, they go to bed around about 7:30, and then, you know, the baby at the moment is literally just feeding, sleeping every sort of 2-3 hours. So we've just got lots of time where we can't do much because of the noise in the house. So we're just literally just watching TV, and we're watching like about 5 or 6 hours every evening now.
Oh, wow.
Like, oh, fuck. Yeah, it's a lot.
That's a lot.
yeah, but yeah, I'm terrible because you know, TV's different now. Is it? When we were kids, you know, you'd watch something. It's like, oh, next Friday night we watch the A-Team again. Yeah, right. Great. But now it's just like, would you like to watch another?
Yeah.
Would you like to watch another? You're just like, oh, fuck.
Right.
And you're hours deep into something then. It's a big investment. Jeez.
I got to ask you, what kind of snacks are you eating during your four-hour marathons?
Cheetos? Just so badly. a lot of crisps, yeah. Or chips, as you'd call them. Yeah. A lot. But I've become, like, the worst sort of dad at the moment. So we're all sitting down eating, and when the kids aren't eating, I'm like, you can't waste stuff, and I'm finishing the kids' food. Sure. I'm at the moment, I'm in bad shape, really bad shape. And I seem to go in like really bad waves.
Yeah.
But I'd say the last 2, possibly 3 weeks, I've been fucking, it's disgusting. It is disgusting.
Are you much of a leftover eater?
Yes.
You are. Okay. Yeah. That has been my move. For a long time, I was finishing my kids' food, but it was always I was uncomfortable, and because I was just eating too much at meals, and so I've started throwing them into storage containers, and then that just becomes my my lunch for the next day.
The next day, yeah. But I'm terrible, so I'll maybe cook like for the kids.
Sure.
And as I'm prepping, I'm eating.
Oh yeah, of course.
And, you know, then we all sit down to eat. Then I'll have what they've left. And it's just like, I don't know. But we've got this bit of a joke in the house where if I'm not 90% full, I'm hungry. you know, it's like, you hungry? Well, I'm about 92%. It's like, yeah, you must be hungry then.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Yeah, I'm always to the limit at the moment, and I need to sort something out.
Yeah.
Summer's coming, but, you know.
Well, you got to get those nips out.
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah,
on your new estate.
I'm a stress eater. I'm a stress eater. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think, oh fuck it. You know, it's only food, but you regret it. But.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, I just got to a point. I was just so uncomfortable, and I hated that feeling. I'm just like, I'm not doing that anymore because it just ruins the enjoyment of eating. And like, it gets to like the food's great up to a point, and then you overeat, and then it's like, so uncomfortable, and then it's not even something nice to look back on. Even if the first part of the meal was great, I'm still like, I just feel like shit later.
That's the thing. You feel like shit, and you think that was just like wasted calories because there wasn't that much enjoyment in that, you know?
Right,
and
exactly.
I'm the worst, but yeah, something's got to change. Yeah. I don't know what yet. There's too much going on for me to change, right. But. Soon. The diet starts Monday, as people always say. Yeah.
Have you been playing Hurdle very much?
I haven't. Yeah. Only what we tried to play last week.
Do you want to try to get... I have one well. Today's queued up.
You've got one queued up? Okay, let's do it.
I'll try
it.
I got the volume cranked up, and it's right next to the mic. Here we go. Ready?
Bye, it's rolling.
Is that Mark... You did all the Amy Winehouse stuff. Mark Ronson, sounds like his voice.
I don't know.
Is it? I'll guess that it is. I'm going to say, is it Valerie by Amy Winehouse?
That's a great cover. Valerie. Mark Ronson, Valerie featuring Amy Winehouse. Let's try it.
Is it?
Oh, I'm submitting right now.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah, fucking yes.
You killed it. 1 second.
It was. I only knew that because I knew his voice when he said that.
I've never heard that version. Honestly.
No, I don't think I have, actually, no. But it was literally just his voice.
That's fucking crazy. You've never heard that song, but you recognize his voice.
I know the song, but I don't know if I've heard that version.
Well, sorry, that version of the song.
Yeah,
that's wild. Yeah, that was 1 second. Yeah. So the way it breaks it down is you get 1 second, 2 seconds, then 5 seconds, then 11 seconds, and then finally 16 seconds.
I got you.
To figure out the song. But you got it in the first one. Yeah, it would have probably taken me about 6 seconds until I started hearing Amy Winehouse's voice.
That bass line, that ding, ba-ding, 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 boom. Yeah.
Yeah, there was one the other day.
This is a new bit every week, doing a hurdle.
Doing a hurdle at the end, yeah. We're not ruining it for anybody because they're getting it late anyway. There was one a couple days ago that was like drumsticks tapping together. And she's like, shh, shh, shh. And it's like somebody counting up 1, 2, 3. And I was like, What? That could be fucking anything.
It could be anything.
So you actually had to get to like to the 6 second portion before you started hearing the guitar. And the second I heard the guitar, I was like, oh, that's Bruno Mars. Because I recognized the riff at the beginning of Locked Out of Heaven.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. Music quizzes are my thing. I'm all over them.
Honestly, that's my wife hates that game because she recognizes songs, but she can never remember the name of the song or the artist. But
doing that thing where you're singing the song in your head, trying to get to the chorus quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Some things when we were driving more together, we would jump around through the different radio stations, and we would just play like the first couple seconds, which is change the station and then turn it off and be like, what's the song? She's like, I fucking hate this game. I have no idea. But
I'd be all over that. And my wife's the same. She's just like, to be honest, she's not really that interested in music at all.
Oh, okay.
So like, she's just like, oh Craig, just shut up, just I don't care. And I'm like, oh no, do you realize that this bass player played on this and that? She's like,
I'm glad that wasn't a deal breaker for you.
Yeah, no, not at all, not at all.
Nice.
Right. Well, I think that's a show. That was a good one. That was a really good one. So I'll get this edited up. It'll be out on Monday. Thank you all for listening. The Jeff will be back next week. And remember, get your questions to us, Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. And remember to support our sponsors because, they've been sponsors for a long time and they do good stuff. We only work with people who do good stuff, you know. So, go take a look. In the show notes, there'll be a full list of them. And if you're going to get your stuff, you might as well get it with a discount too. Might as well. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get everything for your next project today at Menards and save big money. Keep your walls and trim protected while you paint with Scotch Blue Painter's Tape. It's designed for use on multiple surfaces and can be removed easily without leaving residue behind. Save big on Scotch Blue Painter's Tape from Menards. Also, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and check out all of our great deals happening this week. Save big.